This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. 30 years after his death, Malcolm X is now a hero to the hip-hop culture. Young people sport his name on their caps and T-shirts. My guest, Michael Eric Dyson, teaches a seminar on Malcolm X. He's mediated conflicts that have broken out as his black male students, black female students, white students, and Asian students disagreed over the meaning of Malcolm X's life. Now Dyson has written a new book called Making Malcolm, The Myth and Meaning of Malcolm X. Dyson directs the Institute of African American Research at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. He's also an ordained Baptist minister. One day, Professor Dyson stormed out of his seminar on Malcolm X. He told me why.
During the entire semester, there had been a power struggle, if you will, between different versions of Malcolm X and who would own them and who would be able to exercise them within the context of the class. And several black male students of mine were quite vigilant in their insistence that their version of Malcolm be the one that was represented in the class. I certainly understood why they would be that aggressive, but it disrupted the flow of the class and the ability to engage in critical dialogue about what is essentially an enormously important figure and area of our own national history. So I had tried various methods to try to diffuse some of the tension, but quite unsuccessfully. So finally, it built to such a pitch that I finally had to say to them, we can no longer go on like this. And a comment from one of the students that I took to be quite disrespectful and rude was the straw that broke the proverbial camel's back. And
go ahead.
No, and I then stopped the class and stormed up to my office upstairs.
Now, what was your students' version, the black male students in your class, what was their version of Malcolm X?
Well, they were trying to insist that one had to root and ground one's understanding of Malcolm in as close a biographical approximation of his life as possible, so that you had to imitate his life experience. In failing that, you had to understand his life experience from a personal, existential rooting. So if you were a black male, if you were poor, if you were angry, and so on, you had a better understanding or possibility to understand the experience of Malcolm than, say, other students in the class who were perhaps Asian or mixed race or biracial, or those who were not as down with the nationalist program, perhaps, as they were. So there was a kind of politics of authenticity and experience that grounded their own understandings of Malcolm X.
I know one of the things that disturbed you was that you felt that even African-American women were considered less credentialed to truly understand Malcolm X's life.
Yes, yes. Well, I think that one of the real difficulties was that many of the black men in that class felt that because of their gender experience, that they were black, angry men who somehow had a right to Malcolm's interpretation and experience, foreclosed the possibility that women could understand him. And that's based upon all of these arguments going around now in the academy about so-called identity politics. That is, how you root your own experience in particular ways that give you a kind of access to this experience that others might not share. And what they were saying essentially was that women didn't have that same experience, and because they didn't have that same experience, they couldn't have that understanding. They were drawing relationships between experience and knowledge, between understanding and one's own particular authentic rooting in a particular tradition. And so what I was trying to do was to disrupt that. I was trying to suggest many of us have access to Malcolm's legacy precisely because it is now public and not private. It is both rooted in the racial understanding of black culture, but it transcends a mere racial rooting, which suggests that even though you root it in black culture, it's not limited to black culture in terms of who is able to understand it and who's able to participate in the exploration of that legacy.
Now, what about your ability to truly understand Malcolm X's story and the meaning of his life? Did your students question your ability to really understand that?
Yes, they did. I found out later in this conflagration that occurred after I dismissed the class that many of them, you know, queried me why we were wondering why you were teaching this class and what was it about your experience that allowed you, you know, we were suspicious of you. They were quite explicit about that. And I think that, you know, my own feeling that being reared in the ghetto of Detroit as one of a family of seven people, I felt in one sense that that didn't give me a privilege over others who, say, for instance, were born in upper middle class black families in California. But I never saw it that way. Their suspicions, I think, were raised because I was willing both to understand Malcolm's experience, but also to question it, to raise powerful and poignant questions about that experience, even as I appreciated how it had been marginalized within both the American higher education and in the larger popular culture.
So did you ever have a reconciliation with your students after the blow-up?
A reconciliation of sorts. We had, after that conflagration, they came up to my office. We had a tremendous debate. There was exchange of heated words and passionate exchanges. And finally, tears from me. And I said to them, listen, you're tremendously important figures. You're all very bright and very young, and you have important things to say. But we have to move beyond this kind of sustained bitterness and the politics of resentment to get to a place where we don't reduce debates about black culture to curricula vitae. Who is blacker than the next person? Who is more authentic than the next person? That kind of dialogue and debate is vicious, and it has only negative consequences because it goes on forever. There's always somebody who's going to be so-called blacker than you, somebody who's more authentic to you than you, and that just ends in a way that is quite counterproductive to the kind of debates we want to see occur.
What do you think the politics of identity is framing so many conversations within the classroom now?
Well, because I think that part of it has to do with the very presence of black and brown and gay and lesbian and Asian American and Native American and other minority bodies. It's one thing for people ideally to talk about the politics of diversity and multiculturalism. It's another thing when those folks show up. You articulate it's ideal, it sounds good, we're open to it, it's as American as apple pie. But when those black bodies and brown bodies and Native American bodies show up, there's a different nuance, there's a different style, there's a different politics of embodiment that you have to deal with, because those folk are not going to just cooperate with the program of diversity in its bland emphasis. What they're going to try to suggest is that we've got to do things differently and we've got to think about questions differently. So the very presence of these different students, I think, has alarmed those who felt that diversity could go on in relatively easy manner. Secondly, I think what's happening is that many minority communities are trying to reclaim their own identities back from the very people who represented them by proxy. What I mean by that is this, that for so long, black people and Native Americans and gays and lesbians and so on had to be represented by well-meaning, well-intentioned, in the most part, white liberals who were animated and who were impassioned about the plight of these minority communities. But they spoke for them. When blacks and gays and lesbians and Native Americans and Asian Americans show up to speak for themselves, they have different accents, and Latinos and Latinas, they have different accents, different emphases, different ways of expressing themselves that combine both the experience of their own particular culture with a drift toward universal experience. But that combination can be quite alarming and disruptive to business as usual. And then thirdly, I think what's going on is that for so long, the politics of American identity have been about particular identities that were seen to be universal. The white male experience, for instance, was seen to be universal, so it didn't have to be identified as a particular slant on something larger. But when African Americans and Latinas come along, they look like they're practicing the poisonous politics of identity as opposed to what white men have been doing all along. And so the problem becomes, how do we find common ground beyond the most punishing aspects of those politics of identity to suggest that the politics of identity have been going on all along, but now we're trying to make them the basis not for mere exclusionary debates about American democracy, but how we can open it up further.
So tell me some more about how you deal with debates that are rooted in the politics of identity when you're teaching. You're teaching African American studies.
That's right.
You're a black man yourself.
Yes.
Your classes are, I imagine, mixed, male, female, African American, Asian, is that?
Yes, Native American, particularly mm-hmm. Latin American and so on, yes.
Mm-hmm. And okay, you understand the politics of identity,
yes.
Both in its strength and its limitations.
That's right.
So, I mean, it's not like you're someone who's a racist and is completely closed to comprehending what this is about.
Sure.
So what kind of balance are you trying to achieve now, and how do you yeah. incorporate your awareness of it into the actual conversation in class?
Yeah, well, it's a very difficult process. It's a tricky balancing act. Because on the one hand, you want to say to people, listen, I understand you. And, you know, Native Americans, Latino Americans, and, you know, Asians and so on, and gays and lesbians even. You want to say, I understand that. Because as a person of color, and as a person who, you know, I'm now, 36 years old, I went to college at 21, I understand what a struggle that was, and I remember that quite vividly. And I know what it means to be in an environment where people are either ignoring who and what you are or hostile to it. So and that's embodied in me, and it's embodied in my own pedagogical style. That is the way in which I approach teaching in the classroom. On the other hand, what I'm trying to suggest to my students is that there are other traditions that are important, and simply because they've been given short shrift or bad name in these brutal battles over multiculturalism doesn't mean you can't take from them something that's important for your own experience. For instance, you know, I suggested to them, I grew up listening both to Motown, William Smokey Robinson, one of the great poets of the latter part of the 20th century, as far as I'm concerned, Smokey Robinson, that wrote songs for Motown, was important to me. But so was Alfred Lord Tennyson. So when he writes, though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will, to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. That's a very important part of my own history as a person of color trying to come to grips with the ways in which I was excluded from American society, but now through education I can become an active participant in redefining traditions of American democracy. On the other hand, I suggested them, but so is Snoop Doggy Dogg. You know, when he says, woke up, jumped out my bed, I'm in a two-man cell with my homie little half dead. Murder was the case that they gave me. Dear God, I wonder, can you save me? That bit of the flora and fauna of pop culture as seen through rap music is just as important.
My guest is Michael Eric Dyson, author of the new book, Making Malcolm, The Myth and Meaning of Malcolm X. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Michael Eric Dyson, author of the new book, Making Malcolm. He directs the Institute of African American Research at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Dyson took an indirect route to college. After getting a scholarship to the prestigious school Cranbrook, he dropped out, got his high school diploma through night school, married, became a father, did factory work, became a Baptist minister, then at the age of 21, went to community college.
I went to historically black university, Knoxville College, for 2 years, first before transferring. And that school took many people, as many open admissions public schools do, took students who were virtually, you know, unlearned and turned them into productive members of society. I mean, I've seen it happen too often. There's no doubt that the burden is heavier on those institutions. It's no doubt that those public schools then compromise the so-called standards that were previously achieved. And even though the burden is heavier upon professors like myself, who then have to deal with the educational levels of the students we face in the classroom, I would prefer to have that burden than the burden imposed upon us by having a population that has no access to education, and the consequences socially would be much more devastating.
Well, I'm interested in hearing more about how you deal with that burden when you're a teacher. Do you have a lot of students who have trouble just reading the books that you assign, and who can't really express themselves in writing when it comes time to write an essay?
Sure. Well, you know, I taught for 2 years at Brown University. I've also taught at a seminary. And now I'm teaching at a prestigious public school, University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. So the educational level of the students, although varying among those three populations, was still relatively high. That is, students came prepared, especially at Brown University, for intense intellectual engagement. And also at the University of North Carolina, students are quite able. Now, there are varying degrees of capacity. And so what I try to do is to pitch my class in a way that I'm both, you know, demanding of them, as well as tailoring my own teaching to their needs. You know, I'm also a Baptist minister, so I'm an old hand at trying to meet people where they are. As I used to say when I used to preach, God loves you just as you are, but God loves you too much to leave you that way. Well, I don't fancy myself to be God, but I love my students as they are, but I love them too much to leave them that way. If they're sharp, I want to make them sharper. If they're not as sharp as they ought to be, I want to sharpen them. And that means that I have to be diverse. I have to be open. I have to be flexible. I have to know how to test the weather of the classroom, and do they need to read this week something that's sophisticated and theoretical, or next week do they need to know have it expressed to them in ways that are much more accessible? And so you have to experiment with American education to bring them up to par. And I try to do a mix of both theoretical, heavy, intellectually based writings, as well as those that are more accessible in a pop culture vein. And I think we have to do that in order to both bring our students up to speed, but also to be taught by them about different forms of literacy.
How do you deal with grading when, and I assume this has happened to you, when you have a student who, because of their economic background, has a lot of things that they have to deal with outside of the classroom, maybe
sure.
family problems or
yeah.
or just like economic problems, they're holding down a lot of jobs or
yeah.
Or
yeah.
you know, maybe they're already a parent and they have a child or children to bring up. So it's not just a question of, well, you go home and you hit the books every night. There's
That's
a lot
right.
of serious things competing for their time. If a paper or a test isn't really up to snuff academically, for someone who you know is really doing their best, but they're up against all these other problems, do you cut them a break, or do you just have this like one academic standard? Do you anguish over this a lot?
Yeah, well, I do anguish because I think nobody has, and that's a tricky question because you're damned if you do, damned if you don't. But I think that nobody has one, unyielding standard. And if you do, it's quite insensitive and hostile to the way in which education actually operates. I think I have high standards. That my students often complain about the amount of reading they have to do. They both have a very sympathetic ear in me, those students who have hardship, as well as a hard taskmaster. Because, you see, I worked in a factory from the 3 to 11 shift as I was studying Nietzsche during the day and doing cleaning and degreasing during the night, working in an automobile factory. So I'm not insensitive to what it means to have a child, to have a family, to work in a factory, and then to be a full-time student. They have a sympathetic ear in me, but it's also an ear that says, I'll listen to you, but also I'll demand more from you. And to make the hard choices that are necessary when a person has to balance school and work and family. At the same time, I don't place so much emphasis on grading as I place on learning. If a student is putting out for me, that is, a student is engaging in reading of the text and wrestling with the ideals and coming to a more powerful grasp over the set of books and readings that I want them to do, that's much more important to me than the politics of grading.
Michael Eric Dyson is my guest, and he's the director of the Institute of African American Research at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Now, I know that your brother is serving a life sentence for second-degree murder.
Yes.
And I'm wondering how old you were when that happened and if that was something that you could see coming?
It was about 5 years ago, so I was about 30 years old when I found out that my brother was accused of murdering a man. And in one sense, I could see it coming because I grew up in that condition. Several of my brothers have had a difficult time finding employment in Detroit, Michigan, where we grew up. Now, that doesn't mean that I by any means blame this larger structural reality for choices that each of us made. My brother, who's now serving time in prison, was by no means without some kind of record that he had been engaged in certain forms of crime that he talks about. But we believe he's innocent of the crime for which he was charged. But the environment and the conditions under which he lived certainly meant that he was sorely tempted and seduced by the life of crime and the luxuries, if you will, not simply economically, but the luxury of being taken seriously as a human being who had some contribution to make. I mean, and as idiotic as that may sound and as morally perverse as that may appear, what that culture of crime often provides for young men, especially young black men, is a place of importance, a recognition of their authority, and a kind of acknowledgement that they are somebody who can make a contribution to a gang or a group of people. And my brother certainly fell into the trap, and I could have so easily fallen into that trap.
Do you feel that way?
Oh, without question, because, you know, I was involved in gang activity early in my life, the Stanford Gang in Detroit, Michigan, the street over from us. And I grew up in the inner city, and I was... I certainly was subject to those kind of inclinations. And were it not for the strong intervention of the Black Baptist Church and my pastor, Dr. Frederick George Sampson, that could have easily been me.
Do you think that there's a pattern emerging now among people who grow up in African-American families that don't have much money, that grow up in the inner city, where, you know, one sibling ends up going to school, educating themselves, doing really well, and another sibling ends up turning to crime. I'm just thinking, you know, recently, just in terms of people who've been guests here on Fresh Air and who've recently written books.
Yes.
There's you, and we've been talking about your brother. John Edgar Wideman's brother is serving a life sentence for murder.
That's right.
And Brent Staples, who had a very well-received book earlier this year as an editor at the New York Times, his brother was killed.
That's right. That's right.
Do you see some kind of pattern emerging that from people who are growing up in a kind of more exposed to extremes,
extremes
and social extremes?
Well, we're probably writing about it. It probably has gone on for, you know, much longer than we've acknowledged it or talked about it or been able to speak about it in public without being seen on the one hand as Horatio Alger's in blackface, lifting ourselves up by our bootstraps and having our stories used against the very brothers we want to help or the very people who have been left behind. So there's always the danger of the political use of your own story of coming to maturity in situations that bless you and burden the people left behind.
Well, burdening other people and saying, well, look, he did it, so that means it's your fault that you haven't succeeded.
That's right. You know, why can't you do it? You know, your brother did it. He went to Princeton and got a PhD. He started behind the eight ball. He was a teen father, you know, and so on and so forth. Why can't you do it? And that's precisely the uses we don't want put. At least I don't want made of my story. My story should say, if this person got out of it, then what should we be doing to make sure that we can identify other more talented people or equally talented people who deserve to make it? And so the political uses of our stories would be different. And I think that we have to say, what allowed this person to escape? What allowed them, despite those limitations, to succeed? And how can we then identify other gifted people who may not make it the same way Michael Eric Dyson did, or John Edgar Wideman did, or Brent Staples did, and yet who are equally deserving? That's what we've got to do.
Well, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you very kindly. It's been a pleasure to be here.
My guest is Michael Eric Dyson. He's the author of the new book, Making Malcolm, The Myth and Meaning of Malcolm X. He directs the Institute of African American Research at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.